Welcome to Failing Up, a podcast where we explore failure.
Why we're afraid of it, why we try to avoid it, and the success that can arise directly from it.
Failure comes in many shapes and forms. It could even mean different things to different people.
This show, Failing Up, intends to explore all aspects. These are the stories of people who have experienced profound failures that ultimately led them to something positive.
We hope this helps us all learn and grow. Thanks for listening.
My name is Eden.
And I'm Guy. So thank you for doing the show, Zeb. Really glad you're here, obviously. Yeah. I've done research on you. I know all about you. I'd like to start kind of at the beginning.
Okay.
And go from there. I know you were born in upstate New York, in the Catskills.
Yeah, that's where I was raised. I was born in New Orleans.
Oh.
But I sort of identify as like the upstate New York thing is where I was like raised.
Oh, okay. That's where you grew up.
That's where I grew up, yeah.
Till for how many years?
We were there until like senior year in high school. I went to a boarding school in North Carolina called School of the Arts for a year. And then I like spent some time in Europe and then I went to Juilliard.
I should introduce you, Zeb Newman.
Yeah.
Hello, Newman.
Hey.
I had to do it, but I also felt like a piece of crap doing it. Sorry, I apologize. I'm sure I was the first person.
You guys can't see this, but I'm giving Guy this really weird sneer.
It's like, okay. You can ask me if my sister's name is Girl, and when I grow up, if I'll be Man.
Yeah.
The answer is yes to both of them. So as a young man growing up in upstate New York, I know there's not a lot going on in upstate New York. Are you a fairly normal kid?
Oh, yeah, totally normal. I mean, my parents were divorced, and my mom was sort of, she was a real entrepreneur. She had, she developed this company called, what was it called? It was a tape recorder for when you're working at home that would play a sound effects of an office called Office Chatter. And she got a lot of press for it. Like she was on Donahue and like in People Magazine.
Oh, wow.
And like, it was sort of like a big deal. Nothing came from that company. Like everyone in the, I remember my babysitter at the time said to my mom, I need a raise. And my mom was like,
I can't afford to pay you,
you know?
So wait, the idea is that you play the sound. So if somebody calls, it sounds like you're in a professional office.
Yeah, yeah. She was like a single mom working at home and she came up with this idea that, to give the illusion that you were in an office for people to take you more seriously.
Yeah. Phil, I need a fax right now.
Yeah, okay? it was a lot of that and a lot of like phones ringing and fax machines and stuff like that.
That's pretty brilliant.
Yeah, it was
actually
really good. And she's, you know, she's always been a very entrepreneur. She has a very successful real estate company in North Carolina now, and she's, you know, she's really big into that. She's always sort of, when we were little, we had like a cleaning company, my twin sister and I. We were like always doing stuff, like working and stuff. So I wasn't really in any trouble or anything.
Okay, but were you artistic as a kid?
I was quiet, very quiet. And, you know, the divorce had like a really big impact on me. And I was sort of always estranged from my father. And my mom had sort of like a few years where she was a little overworked and she wasn't very available.
Okay.
And so I was sort of, you know, quiet and kept to myself. And so when I got into the art side of things, it was, you know, my mom took my sister and I to an audition for some like summer theater thing.
Uh-huh.
And, my sister like had like a meltdown at the audition and my mom was like, well, we're here. Zeb, do you want to try? And I tried and I got a part. And so it was sort of always this thing I did on the side that wasn't like a big focus for me until later in life.
When that happens, are you thinking like, I'll just do it. I'm not going to get the part. Or did you really think?
I think I just did it to upstage my sister and to, you know what I mean? Have like a moment. I wasn't really thinking about it, which I think is the key to like being successful in that sort of industry is to sort of not be that invested into the outcome. You know, and so it was like a music man, and I was boy number two. And it was like a great summer. You know,
yeah.
It was a ton of fun, and it sort of got me in that world.
Okay, and is that what got you to go to a performing arts school?
Yeah,
okay,
pretty much.
You said you're like in your senior year of college?
Yeah, senior year of high school. Yeah, I went, auditioned for North Carolina School of the Arts, got in. I went there, and, you know, we didn't do as many like theater things as we did just sort of like lots of theater studies, like mass class and movement and stuff like that. But we didn't do a lot of plays there.
What's your audition? Is it a monologue?
Yeah, it was a monologue and, you know, some stupid Shakespeare monologue that I, you know, put together at the last second. And, you know, it was I never took it really seriously until later. You know, it was sort of always this thing that I was kind of good at and people sort of like acknowledged. I wasn't very athletic and I didn't stand out in any other way, but I would sort of get some attention by doing these like theater things. And so I sort of gravitated towards that.
But you're shy, yet when you're on stage, you feel like...
Yeah, yeah. I mean, I struggled with stage fright always. You know what I mean? Like even later, like I really struggled with stage fright. But once I got out there and I got going, it would be, you know, it'd be free and fun.
And so at this school, it's a boarding school, you said?
It's a boarding school, yeah.
Are you getting in any trouble at that point?
No, I really didn't get into any trouble until later.
But so from there, you go to Juilliard?
Yeah, well, I take some time and I go to Europe for like a year and a half. And then I come back and I know from being in Europe and like without a job and sort of floating around, I realize that I need to like go to college. Like that's like a big thing for me. So I apply to a couple of schools and on the off chance, I applied to Juilliard. And, you know, I went to the audition and there was like hundreds of kids and it was a very intense day and I just kept getting called back and called back. And then I made it to the final round and then like a few weeks later, I got an acceptance letter.
That's crazy.
It was really crazy. I mean, it was like a magical experience and the whole, it was like a coveted thing, you know, like people in my family were sort of like shocked by it. I was shocked by it. I got a scholarship. It was like a big deal, but I got really lost in like, oh, I'm going to Juilliard. And I didn't really like think about like what that meant and right. like what I was going to be responsible for doing when I was there. I just was sort of lost in the whole mystique of it. It was like super exciting. And, you know, being at Lincoln Center was amazing. And but when I got there, I had a really rude awakening of the people that are there are very serious about it. And I never really thought of it as something that I was going to like do professionally until I got there. And I'm, you know, with people in my class who are like, you know, all state champions of wherever they're from. And they're, you know, very serious about it. And so I quickly assimilated and, you know, got on board with the program. But it was an amazing experience.
So your classmates have it all figured out. This is what I'm doing. I'm going to be a Shakespearean actor.
Yes, or I want to be on TV and like I want to be on Broadway. And I just never really thought that far in advance.
So but, you don't even take it seriously. Well, it doesn't sound like you took it too seriously when you, even though it was an intense situation, it didn't sound like you were like...
I'm a twin, and so I have a competitive nature in me. You know, it's in my blood.
Yeah.
And so when I got there and I quickly realized that, you know, this was like a serious thing, I, you know, quickly, you know, put my program in check and started to show up. But it was, I remember getting there the first few weeks and just sort of looking around like, oh my God, this is amazing. And not really seeing that like, you know, things were happening there that I needed to like show up and participate in. And so, you know, my whole experience there was great. Like I got great parts, you know what I mean? I was on scholarship. I got to work with amazing people and it was fun, but it was there that I started to gravitate more towards like extracurricular activities.
When it comes to Juilliard, I don't know about you, Eden, but I think of it as like, and in its own way, but like Harvard, like very few people get to go to, that's a very, yeah, very prestigious.
It's an interesting thing because like they say like thousands of kids try out and they only take 20. And so you're sort of in there, you're fighting the odds just to get in. And then when you get in, there's 20 fucking other people there that you're competing against, you know, yeah. What I mean? So it's sort of like constantly you're having to compete. Yeah, it never ends.
You know what I mean? Are you feeling pressure? Because I the one person I know that went to Juilliard, this girl is a piano like amazing. Like she can listen to any song immediately playing it on the piano.
Yeah, she
can hear a car horn and go, "That was an F sharp."
Yeah.
Like and that's who I think of when I think of Juilliard. So there must have been pressure.
There was a lot of pressure.
You're a genius.
Yeah, that's what I think. No, seriously.
Hardly not a genius.
You get into Juilliard, you're probably a genius.
No, I think that I was just charming enough and they sort of, in my life, there have been a series of like unbelievable miracles that have sort of happened and getting into Juilliard was definitely a big miracle in my life. I wasn't planning on it. It wasn't something that I like grew up wanting, but when it happened, I you know, was amazed and, you know, the excitement of it was the most sort of engaging thing for me. Just being there, being at Lincoln Center, working in those master classes, being in class with like Oscar Isaac and Jessica Chastain and Rutina Wesley and like all of these amazing young people. It was on. You know, it was definitely on. And when I got there, I showed up, but it took me a second to sort of. I think I spent a lot of my childhood tuned out, like totally tuned out, like blank years of just blankness, you know what I mean? And so that is still stored, that stays with me today. Like a lot of times, especially in my job now, I have to like remind myself, like Zeb, like wake up, you know what I mean? Like yeah. This is happening now.
Like almost like you're not in the moment.
Yeah, exactly. Huh. That's why I think I gravitated so much towards drugs because it just turned everything off and everything is way off. And I didn't, you know, so.
Okay, so maybe we should jump to that. So Juilliard, you said was your first, that was your first experience.
Yeah.
How old are you at this point when you first tried any kind of drug?
I mean, I had sort of always, you know, smoked pot and, you know, at North Carolina School of the Arts, I got like alcohol poisoning. And,
oh, wow.
You know, it was sort of something that was kind of attached to me, but it wasn't, it wasn't like an issue until I got to Juilliard. And it wasn't, I was never using drugs with the kids in Juilliard. It was always things I was doing like on the weekends or after school. And then it became an everyday thing.
I was curious to, actually, yeah. Were the people in Juilliard, because I mean, when I was in college, like everyone was doing drugs.
Yeah.
You know? Were people in Juilliard doing drugs? Because I feel like that's such a school where, like, you notice if someone's off.
There's not.
You can't really sleep your way through Juilliard.
There's,
but you can sleep your way through, like, you know, University of Wisconsin.
Yeah, no, right. I've often thought, like, why didn't anyone sort of raise an alarm about me earlier?
Right.
You know, because eventually, in the middle of my third year, in the middle of, like, a really big production of Richard III, which I had, like, great parts in, and I had to stop and go to rehab. And wow. So I think a lot about, I have this, like, recurring nightmare where I'm trying to get back into Juilliard. And it's like still to this day, like just a few weeks ago, I had this nightmare where I wake up and I'm like, why am I still trying to finish this thing? But nobody really noticed. And no, I wasn't really doing it with anyone else there because everyone's tired. Yeah. Everyone's exhausted. Everyone's stressed out. Everyone's trying and working and
everyone looks like they're on drugs.
Yes. Yeah. So it was sort of, but to my knowledge, there wasn't, you know, any, and that they have like they have a zero tolerance policy for all that
That's
stuff.
What I
so,
thought.
But yeah. You obviously bypassed that. What's the first thing you got into? Was it coke?
Yeah, that was sort of the big first thing that I sort of got into. And, you know, I was doing tons of ecstasy and dabbling in like snorting heroin and starting to do crystal meth when I was in Juilliard. And, you know, it was like, it's crazy that I went to rehab. I've been to rehab several times, but the first time I went to rehab was at Juilliard, which is crazy because my real drug using career didn't start until way after that.
Really?
Yeah.
Okay, so something happened at Juilliard then.
I think I just had been partying too much and came into school one day and was like, I can't do this anymore. You know what I mean? Like, I can't, this double life that I'm living is like, it's killing me. I need to take a break. And I might have told someone who then raised an alarm. And then like hours later, I'm checking into like a rehab in Pennsylvania.
Wow. So what are you doing though at that point? Are you like doing coke all night and then going to class? Or like, what's the big thing that's holding you back at that period?
I think a lot of cocaine.
Okay.
I think it was a lot of cocaine and, you know, just a lot of ecstasy and just a lot of drugs. No sleep, not eating. You know, smoking like two packs of cigarettes a day, just like, you know, not taking care of myself. And, you know, I think sleep deprivation is a major issue. You know, it can really bring out the worst in people. And
yeah.
So I wound up going to rehab there. They sent me to this like fancy rehab in Pennsylvania. And I was there I was supposed to be there for 30 days, but at 21 days, I sort of had convinced everyone that I was good and that I was fine and that I knew what I was doing.
You are a good actor.
Yeah. And then I was and so they let they let me leave early.
How did you do that?
They let me leave and I go back to New York and now Juilliard is like, okay, that's great. You know, you sort of completed rehab, but now you need to do 6 months of like outpatient. And they gave me this long list of requirements to get me back into the program. And I just couldn't follow through with any of them. I went to like two outpatient meetings and I was like, fuck this. Like I can't. And I was using like weeks later. And so that whole dream sort of went away. And then I sort of fast tracked myself. Well, I need a job. Like I knew that my class was going to graduate the next year and agents and stuff were already swarming around us, you know? And so I sort of just took as many meetings as I could and tried to downplay the whole rehab thing. And I wanted to create this illusion that I had left Juilliard for some big role, but that wasn't the case.
First time you're in rehab, so it sounds like you weren't in the moment again.
No, not at all.
Were you thinking when you're in rehab, this isn't working? Or did you actually kind of believe
it? Going through the motions just to get out of it?
I think I was so paralyzed with shame and fear that I had fucked it up.
Yeah.
That I was just doing everything I could to be as good as possible. I don't think I was like trying to pull a fast one. I think I genuinely wanted to like go back to, I mean, I had slept and I was not using for a few weeks and like I was feeling better. So I wanted to just get back in and, you know, go back to work at school. And they just were not, you know, when you, at that school, they take it very seriously. So when something like that happens, they like, you know, they're not just going to let you right back in. You have to like do a bunch of shit. But then after that, I did a workshop of a show at the Roundabout and I totally fucked that up and got let go out of the second reading. And then I started booking like commercials and, you know, I was making really good money doing commercials and I was doing like the Law and Order thing and like a couple of jobs in New York and, but totally out of my mind.
Still fucked up.
Still fucked up.
This is like 2007 era?
No, this is like 2004.
Okay.
This is like 2004. Totally fucked up. So I make somehow I pull my shit together. I had like a check or something from a commercial that I had done and I wound up going to Los Angeles. And it was when I landed in LA that I started to, that's when my drug career, I look back and think that's when it started, because that's when I started like shooting drugs. And, you know, I was like every day, all day long, drugs, drugs, drugs. And
okay. So let's go back to New York for a second. So when you're back East, you're not doing it every day, or it's just a party more than like a problem kind of thing? Or?
It's hard to be a professional drug addict in New York. It's expensive. You're in a tiny apartment. You know, there's periods of time where you just can't, you know, waiting on a dealer in New York is like worse than being in prison, I would imagine. You know, because you're just like, it could be their time. Yeah, you're on their time. And like, you know, here in LA, you'll just get in your fucking car and go drive and meet them.
Yeah.
You know, but there, it's also very expensive. And so it was hard to...
The upkeep, yeah.
The upkeep is very hard. It's a tough thing to sort of commit to.
Drug or not, it's expensive.
Yeah, even if you're not on drugs, it's a tough city to navigate. So, but when I landed in LA, it was...
all of a sudden easier.
So much easier. And I was meeting people who, like, you know, we call them like lower companions, who were like doing drugs all day, every day, and just would supply me with things. And, you know, and so I, you know, really gravitated towards that. But I started working a lot as an actor when I was here in LA. I started booking like big jobs on TV shows and more commercials. And I did a play at the Malibu Shakespeare or the Malibu Playhouse. Mm-hmm. And I can't imagine why they did not fire me like 8 million times throughout that play. Cause I was like nodding out on stage.
Oh my God.
It was like so insane how I
and no one said anything.
Nobody was really saying anything to me.
That's shocking.
I think people look at me and they think I'm like a nice, good guy. And and that has worked to my advantage, you know, most of my life. And I think looking back, I've been...
Oh, no. Should we be worried?
No. He did steal something on the way in. Yeah. But I didn't want to say
it. Yeah. It's like one of those things that I don't know why no one really stopped. I never got fired. I got fired eventually, but it wasn't until later.
Got it.
You know what the weird thing about drugs that I found? Now, I feel like they no matter what kind of drug you like, and no matter where you go, it will find you, right? Yeah. You almost don't even need to go and search for it. Like, I smoked a lot of pot. I moved to Ohio. I'm like, I'm going to quit. Literally within like 3 days of being in Ohio, somebody's like, hey, man, got some pot.
Oh, totally.
It. It's like, it just finds
you. Well, I feel like if you're on that frequency, if that's something that's sort of like on your mind... you'll find it.
Yeah.
Like I believe to some extent that stuff is true, like the secret or whatever, that like whatever you're thinking about or whatever you're sort of like wanting will eventually come to you. But sometimes the things you want are not the things you should have.
Sure.
Yeah. It's like, you know, if you deprive yourself of like, I don't know, sugar, all of a sudden you're going to see sugar.
Oh yeah. Everywhere. It's everywhere. Yeah. It's everywhere.
You know, whatever you're going to try to not think about is going to come up.
Yeah, totally.
So you moved out here by yourself?
Yeah, by myself.
With a large check, whatever it was from a commercial?
Yeah. I mean, I had a manager at the time that like brought me out here, and I had like an agency, and I was like doing that thing. And like, you know, it was a lot of auditions, a lot of close calls, like a lot of testing for shows and stuff. And, you know, I literally have a million of these just nightmare experiences of like being so high out of my mind in front of like lights, cameras, and a team of people like looking at watching you. And it was soul crushing. You know what I mean? To be like I did a Honda campaign for like 4 days in Long Beach, and I was standing on a blue screen with like tons of lights. And I had been doing crystal meth, like been shooting it at that point. So I'm like sweating profusely, and the makeup people, they clearly know that something's up.
Right.
But I'm like, and I can barely stand up, but I'm having to like, you know, walk around a car. And like, I mean, just it's so many of those like hellish experiences that I don't know how I survived them.
Yeah, I'm surprised no one even noticed.
Yeah, I mean, I think people were starting to notice. Oh, at that point, people were starting. It was always like the makeup people would notice, or the ADs would notice, or, you know, I was doing an episode of House once on the Fox lot, and I had my like lower, like, these homeless like drug dealers basically come to the lot, and I gave them passes. I told the AD, I was like, can you just like clear this? They didn't have IDs when they got there.
Oh my gosh.
And they let them on the lot, and they were like in my trailer, like doing drugs. And they came over to me, and they were like, this isn't cool. And we're not going to blow you up on this right now, but this cannot happen again. And you will never come back to this lot and bring these people with you. And you need to like shape up. And I remember being like, fuck. But, you know, they never came back to the lot, but I only did one job there.
Hmm. Did you blow it at that point? Like, did they not call you back because of that?
No, I mean, you know, my run of working as an actor was really only 2 years. You know what I mean? And so I sort of like, you know, I had over that time, you know, casting directors, they get to know you and they like you. And I was good at my job, you know, for most of the time. But it was those types of situations that eventually came back to haunt me. I mean, I was, you know, I was a real mess. It got to be, I was doing a movie in Arizona, and you know, it was like a big deal. Like the Hollywood Reporter reported that I got this role, and it was like, you know, it was a small movie, but a lot of people in town, I guess, wanted to get the role. And so I show up on set and I'm like cracked out of my mind, and I sit down and I'm sitting across this from an actress who I went to Juilliard with, who's like a friend of mine. And the director is like starting the scene, and I couldn't cry. I couldn't do anything. And the scene was like a highly emotional scene. And for the audition process, I had been crying like snotty cries. Like been like ugly crying. I was giving it to him like in every way he wanted. And that's why I got the role. Yeah. But then on set in front of all those people, high out of my mind, knowing that my drugs were back in my hotel room and that I needed to do a little bit more to sort of stay right, I couldn't even produce a tear. And I was like paralyzed with fear. And the director was getting so frustrated. And then he was like, fine, fuck it. And then they stopped doing my cameras and they went to her cameras, and she nailed it. And like, she blew it away. So, and it was one of those moments when I realized that like, this might not be for me. Like, and it was really crushing to me because I felt like another opportunity that I just fucked up, and didn't just fuck up. Like, I was so focused on the drugs and that other stuff that was going on that the amazing job and the opportunity that I was having was totally, I wasn't present for it.
Was this Jolene?
It was Jolene. Yeah. Okay. It was Jolene. And you know, Jessica Chastain was like, you know, she was amazing in that movie. And I've since had dinner with the director several times, and you know, I've tried to make amends. I have made amends to him, but you know, he's told me that he had to edit. The editing that film was like really just about editing me or editing around me.
Wow.
Because like so much of I was so inconsistent, and you know, it's like today, the person that I am, if those opportunities came my way, I would be, you know, I'd be rising to the occasion in every way. In my current job, I rise to every occasion, and I never, you know, turn my back on those types of opportunities. But at that time, it was just like, I could not show up. Yeah. I just could not show up. So eventually I was doing a couple episodes on Brothers and Sisters, and my character suddenly got killed off, and I had a meeting with my lawyer, and I was really out of it, and he called my manager, and then the jig was up. Everyone knew that I was on drugs, and then everyone stopped working with me. I lost I had no money. I lost my apartment. Like, you know, when you both don't look like you've ever been evicted from a place, but when you get evicted, you sort of have like 30 days, you know, you get your first eviction notice and you're like, ah, okay, I can like hang with this. And then you wait for the next one. And this was like the third, you know, like get the fuck out notice. So I lost my home, and my mother flew to California to take my car because she had co-signed on the loan. And she didn't want me getting into an accident on drugs. My family, everyone knew I was on drugs at this point.
Let's back up just a tiny little bit. I got to know. So, because this is, I feel for anybody, and maybe I'm wrong when you're so ingrained in it, but to jump from snorting to actually shooting something up, was that a thing for you? Did that register at the time? Like, oh man, I just shot up.
You know, honestly, at that time, I was dealing with so much. Like, I'm motivated by shame and guilt. You know what I mean? Like, those things really, like, I'll fucking move mountains if I feel guilty about something. And drugs were my solution, you know? And they were, so it became this, like, perpetual situation where, like, the problem kept presenting itself as the solution. And because of that, I just needed more and more and more and more of that solution, which was really the problem. So when I started slamming, I remember the very first time I stuck a needle and someone stuck a needle in my arm. By the end, I was shooting up in my neck. So it was like, but I remember thinking like, oh, this is that moment when, you know,
like the tipping point,
this is the tipping point, you know what I mean? And, but I just ran with it, you know what I mean? And I just needed to be totally turned off and tuned out of life. And, you know, so I succumbed to it.
So how long are you we consider heavily into drugs before everybody finds out?
I think I had been the whole time I was out here in California. So a good 2 years, 2 years of being, 2.5 years of being here sort of like heavily into drugs. And, you know, I was lying to everyone in the business, like my manager, my agents, my lawyer, my publicist, everyone I was lying to, you know, nobody really knew. But they knew that I was crazy and that I had like very erratic behaviors. Like I'd go to dinners with them to like meet someone. They'd be like, you need to go meet this person. We're going to have dinner. And I'd show up and I'd be like out of it. And I'd always come up with some excuse or I have to go. I'm really sorry, but I have these other plans. And I'm famous to this day for showing up to places for 5 minutes, saying hello to exactly who I need to say hello to, and then bouncing. I mean, that's just like, and I did it then and I still do it to this day. But this day I'm going home to watch like 48 hours of mystery.
Me too. Yeah,
I'm not like
that.
Going out to like.
I go watch Netflix.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
Maybe I'm jumping ahead, but did you ever explore where this all came from?
The drugs? And
yeah.
I think I was, you know, I hate to put this on anyone and anyone else, but I think as a little kid, I have a lot of brothers and sisters, and my family was, you know, very dysfunctional, and I never felt like unconditional, like I got your back love. You know what I mean? Like I'm going to make sure you're okay no matter what. And I think that, you know, has translated into me needing people to like me, me needing validation from other people. Yeah. And, you know, I think that's what sort of motivated the acting thing, because like, who doesn't want to stand up on stage and get like hundreds of people clapping for them and like standing, like that's an amazing feeling. You know? And so, you know, over time, to fast forward just a little bit, when I eventually decided to stop acting, I sort of felt a sense of relief from that. Like I don't need to get that type of validation from other people. I'm going to find it within myself.
Wow, that's good.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So you quit acting.
Well, I quit. I shouldn't say I got fired from acting.
Okay.
And then I wound up, you know, I was homeless and had no car and no money. And so I just sort of, I spent about a year on the streets of downtown LA on Skid Row.
Whoa.
Yeah, it was tough. It was.
Hold on. Before, so some, there was an, something happened, a rock bottom or whatever you want to call it. Yes, you know, your manager found out and your whole family found out, but something had to happen. What happened for them to find out?
I think I had a meeting with a lawyer who's ironically my lawyer today, and I was, you know, crazy at that meeting, and I think he called.
That was it.
And I had a friend that had a very, she's a very good friend of mine today. I call her like my godmother. She's sober, and she was friends with my manager, and she told him that I was like needed help. And it was a series of like, okay, well, if he's really this crazy and he needs help, like we need to like stop putting him out in audition. We need to like, you know, just
stop
intervene. We need to stop being enablers. Yeah. And so, but when everyone stopped being enablers, like I felt like such a failure that I wanted to just hide from the world. And so I wound up just sort of becoming a crazy homeless street junkie.
So you lose all your money. Well, I would assume drugs are like, you're still finding a way to get drugs in those last 30 days that you're living in that house.
Always drugs, no matter where I was or what I was doing.
So you're stealing?
You know, there were times where I had a lot of money, and so I was bankrolling a bunch of like, you know, homeless people who had drugs. I mean, a good drug addict is going to always know where to get the drugs.
Yeah.
And like, I always knew who the dealer, I always had dealers who were friends of mine. I always knew where I could go to get drugs. But the crazy thing is around that same time when I wound up becoming like, when I went to downtown, dealers were telling me no more. Lower companions were telling me like, you have a problem. I used to run with these two kids who were like insane, like homeless backpackers, you know, and they told me like, we can't chill with you anymore. Cause I was going crazy. You know,
what
like,
do you think? Are you like, fuck you? Or are you like, wow, I must have really, really have a problem.
I think I always knew I had a problem, but I was incapable of doing anything about it. Like I wasn't willing to do anything about it. And you know, I often think like, if at that time I could have pulled my shit together and, you know, gotten sober or gone home and figured shit out, my life might be very different today. But, you know, I love my life today. And so I'm, you know, incredibly, I'm grateful for all of that, even though it took me a long time to get to this place. You know, because being on Skid Row is a tough. I mean, I used to get my ass kicked.
I can't even. Yeah,
I literally used to get my ass kicked like once a week.
I like breaking it down. Like day one, right? You are kicked out of your place. What do you have with you? And you're like, I'm going to take, this is all I have. I'm going to Skid Row. You actually think that's where I should go?
I had gotten a storage unit. So as I was preparing to move out, I put everything in the storage unit, which eventually got, you know, I never paid for it, so everything got thrown out or whatever.
Right.
You know, I had stuff. I had stuff at friends' houses and stuff. It was more, I was in such a, you know, I was in denial and I was incredibly cracked out. You know, like when you're on those types of drugs, like at that level, you're not thinking clearly. And so you're not really thinking about like, oh, you know, do I have my charger? You know, like
this is a good place to get
drugs. Do I have deodorant or like a toothbrush? Like you're not even thinking about that kind of stuff.
Yeah.
And I was so mortified by where I had taken my life that I wasn't willing to like ask people for help. And I wasn't willing to, you know, so I, the lower companions that I used to run with, now I'm looking for like even lower companions. Wow. And, you know, I spent a lot of nights, there's a gas station down by the Staples Center, and I would sit on that corner and watch people walk into the Staples Center. And it was heartbreaking because I would see them and they were like happy and, you know, dressed nice and like with their friends or coworkers, and they were like going to a concert or a game, and I would sit there and I was like invisible to these people, and I would know that everything I'm doing is so wrong. Like, it's not that I wanted what they had, but I wanted to be a part of that because I had so divorced myself from any connection to like friends or family or anyone who knew me and like cared about me. Like, I had no connection to them, and it was a very lonely, lonely time. But eventually I, you know, I suffered a stroke from drug use, and I wound up, I had two massive strokes on the right side of my brain that left my left side paralyzed.
Okay, let's stop right there. That, 'cause that's fucking insane. You, how old were you? 27.
I was 28 when I had
28. Yeah, okay. Heroin, is that what did it?
It was crystal meth. There was a lot of crystal meth. I mean, I liked heroin, but my main thing was like crystal meth.
Smoking it, or are you shooting it?
Okay, shooting, so you're it up shooting in my neck, in my
meth,
arm. Yeah.
You're on. Are you literally on the streets when this?
Yeah, I mean, here's the crazy thing. So while I was on the streets, I was at one of these like hourly hotel places in downtown LA. Yeah, and Somebody sees me and is like, "You that kid from TV, blah blah blah." And I was like, and they were like, "You have tons of money. What are you doing here?" And I was like, "I don't have any money." And they were like, "Every time your show airs, you get paid." And so I took a bus from downtown LA to the Screen Actors Guild office. Oh. And I show up there like unshowered, cracked out of my mind, like with a backpack, sunglasses, like weighing 140 pounds. And I'm like, I'm here to collect my money. Like, and apparently I had like, you know, a lot of residual money. Yeah. And they signed off like a bunch of money to me in a check.
Wow.
And so then I went and got a hotel, and then I got a ticket to fly back to New York because I decided that I needed to like go home and be with my family. And the night that I flew back to New York, the night I landed in my grandmother's apartment, I had a stroke.
Oh.
So you weren't, were you on drugs at that point?
Oh, yeah, yeah. Okay. Oh, my God. Yeah.
Had you just, like, shot up?
There was a ton of drugs in the house because my uncle had died there, and there was a ton of, like, heavy, like, narcotics and stuff there. And I just, you know, I went to town, and I woke up, like, a few days later in a coma.
Who was there when you
got... My grandmother was there. My family had sort of were coming to her house the next morning.
And how long are you there before you have a stroke?
Hours.
So your grandma finds you on the ground?
Yeah, I think, no, it was in a bed. And I think, I don't really know. I think my mom had come over in the morning and, you know, Zebby's here. My family calls me Zebby. And they came into the room and I was like blue and there was like foam on my mouth. And then they took me to the hospital. An ambulance came and it was like very traumatic for my family because the police came, they like, you know, went through everything in the apartment, you know, they were asking them like really, you know, not nice questions.
Yeah,
and it was like it's a very sore,
invasive.
Yeah, it was, oh. It makes me feel very shitty that I put them through that experience. But I you know, wound up.
So you wake up 3 days later.
I could have been five. I have no idea. And in tons of fucking pain, like so much pain that my twin sister flew in, friends suddenly flew in. And so someone was with me at the hospital. My twin sister, her husband, or my mother and our family and friends were there 24 hours. And, you know, I couldn't really talk. I couldn't move my arm or my leg. And I'm on like
so
heavy.
So half of your body's paralyzed.
Half of my body's paralyzed. My leg from my hip down to my knee, I can feel. But from my knee down to my ankle is like totally numb.
Yeah. Wow.
And so, you know, that then began my recovery. Like, you know, the jig was up. And in that time, I, you know, started to like get comfortable with my family again and like sleeping and showering and eating and laughing and watching TV.
Being a human being.
Yeah. But the thing is that I was having extreme PTSD about everything that had just happened.
Yeah. You've been through a lot.
Yeah.
Oh my God. Something.
I couldn't even utter the words California. Like I couldn't even utter the words California. And, you know, it was over months and months that people like that manager reached out and other people reached out. So, and everyone now knew that I had had this stroke, and And then I just started to, at that time, I thought my life was over. You know what I mean? I was living at my mom's house. I was going to physical therapy like 5 times a week and, you know, trying to like get myself back together. And I just, I couldn't even think about the, I couldn't even really talk, and I couldn't think about anything but just like the terror of what I had just been through. And right. It was like, it was a very dark time because I just felt so like, yeah. Done, you know, like it felt like everything was done.
It's not easy to just get up and move on. Yeah, after no, that.
Exactly. And the other thing is like, what was I going to do? Yeah. You know? And so I, you know, I have to say that I wasn't going to Alcoholics Anonymous meetings. I wasn't doing anything sobriety related, and I wound up using drugs again.
So you have a stroke, a literal stroke. Half of your body's numb. How long does it take you to recover
from
that?
My arm was in a sling. The last thing was my arm, and the arm, I was in a sling for like almost a year.
Okay. So it has to be after that that you
first... I'd say like a year and a half afterward, I wound up using drugs one more time.
What possesses you?
I was in physical therapy, and I had this like amazing, like angelic physical therapist woman. So kind. And you know, you meet these women who are just like, they just...
Saints.
Saints. Yeah. You know what
Not
I mean?
Me.
And it's you, like, look, get the fuck you look out like of bed. A saint.
It's like un-me.
You look like a saint.
She, my halo is
whatever
like
the opposite porn. Of Eden is,
that's
you meant.
That's what you meant.
She said to me once, she's like, Zebariah, you need to start thinking about what you want to do with your life because you're going to get a second chance. She's like, so, you know, and in my mind, I was thinking, I want to get high one more time. I mean, I feel like a piece of shit about that I had a stroke. My mom like was like wiping my ass, feeding me, and I wound up using again.
But did you just, I thought you said that you only used once.
One more time, like a year and a half.
Even though it was one more time that you still feel like a piece of shit for?
Well, I feel like it wasn't a good look. I'm an alcoholic, I'm a drug addict, and when I'm not treating myself, I'm, you know, that's what I do. Mm-hmm. I will get high. I will like fuck up my entire life, and I will self-sabotage everything. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, a year and a half of just going to physical therapy and being with my family, like, you know, I wound up using again. But after that night, I came home and my mom was like, you either go to a meeting or you get the fuck out. And AA or any of that stuff had never been part of the dialogue for my like recovery plan at home. And so I went to a meeting the next day. And I should tell you that the entire time I was here in LA, I was in and out of meetings. Like, could not put more... I'd go like a day or maybe a couple of days, or I was in and out of rehabs. And so, I mean, I knew the drill, and I had felt like such a failure in that world that I never considered going to them for any type of help post the stroke. But, you know, I was out of options and incredibly desperate and super freaked out, because getting high after not being high for so long was like such a scary, it like did not feel good. It did not, it made me sort of realize like, this is what I'm like, you know, wanting, like, this is what I want. And I went to a meeting, and then from that day on, I've been sober like now 5.5 years.
So I'm going to back you up. You say, I want to get high one more time. What do you want to get high on in your head?
Crystal meth.
Definitely. Okay. Yeah. And you want to shoot it up?
I mean, I think like I just probably, I didn't shoot it up though. I just,
but the
like,
literal thing that got you into it, had you have a stroke, or yeah, made yeah. you have a stroke, is what you want one more time. It wasn't heroin. It wasn't anything
yeah,
else.
Yeah, it was. Well, I think, you know, when I had the stroke, it was a lot of oxys and stuff that sort of put me over the edge. But I just wanted to get high one more time. In my mind, when she said you could have an opportunity at another life, I was so not thinking about like where my life could be today. I just was thinking like, you know what? I'd like to try drugs one more time and do it professionally this time. Like, just on the weekends. You know what I mean? Like, keep everything sort of
right.
Schedule it in.
Schedule it in, and like, you know, stop on Sunday night. Like, just like fucking put that shit down.
That's easy to do.
And so I realized quickly after that one night that like that was not the case.
That's like portioning out like half a cup of ice cream.
Exactly.
Like, telling you
exactly.
To do.
Like, when like you have a tub of it in your like fridge. Yeah. So I wound up getting sober, and then from that point on, I was like at the bottom. I think today when I see people who are at the fucking bottom and they're out of options and nobody's expecting them and they're sort of up against a wall, to me, that is the most exciting place to be in life. Because when you're at the bottom, the only thing you can do is start to go up. But when you're at the top, if you have to sustain that, like if, for me, if I'm at the top, there's only a couple of things you can do to maintain that. You know, you got to like keep doing what you're doing, or like try to like reinvent what you're doing to make people think that it's good enough to keep watching or whatever. But when you're at the bottom, no one's watching, and anything you do is going to like propel you up. And so for me, like when I'm talking to people who are like struggling with drug and alcohol addiction or in the entertainment business and they feel like they're out and it's over, I'm like, no, this is the time that anything is possible. And I've always, I think I get that from my mom because she's such an entrepreneur. I always sort of envision, I'm always the guy that's like, okay, well, let's flip it. Let's flip it and let's look at it from a different perspective, or let's just try, you know, going for this. Or, and so I, you know, I'm getting sober and like, you know, that there's that whole story. And then I, you know, my mom winds up moving to North Carolina. And so the house that I was living in, like upstairs, like is now gone. So I move in with a friend into an apartment in Harlem and I'm like trying to figure out my life. And I wound up getting this like really random job working for this Travel Channel show that took me to the Caribbean to like do this. Like, I know it's insane.
Are
like
they hiring?
No, exactly. I didn't get paid anything, but I spent like a month like going on all the different islands and like doing these like amazing experiences. And I came back from that experience and I was like, actually the girl that I wound up doing a documentary with is the one that got me that job. So she, so I come back from that experience and I'm like, holy shit. Like in my mind, I was thinking I'll just become an MTA train conductor or I'll get a job at the factory. There's a bunch of cement factories where I'm from. And I'll just, you know, make like a little bit of money and I'll just have a life and that will be it. But then I get this random crazy job and it's like so fun and exciting. I'm like, I'm going to try this. And so I just started applying for every job I possibly could. And I started coming up with like these random TV shows. And I was like, oh my God, the Discovery Networks are in Silver Springs, Maryland, which is like a bus ride away from New York City. So I started going down there like once a month to like annoy the fuck out of the development team there, who always took meetings with me and were very encouraging. But like, you know, it's very misleading because in my mind, I'm like, oh my God, they responded to an email. They're going to buy this show. When really there was like, you know, going down with, they were being very polite. And I think that they were like nice, you know what I mean? Cause I was like very earnest and like sincere with my whatever. But so I just started trying to make stuff happen. And I realized around that time that I, wasn't going to be an actor anymore. And, I felt a huge sense of relief that I could. It was around the time I was, you know, getting sober and in meetings and like doing, I'm a program sober guy. Like there are a lot of people who like don't drink and don't use drugs, but then it's different when you're a program, and I'm program. I'm on steps. I have a sponsor. I have sponsees. I do the whole thing. And so I came to decide that like the acting was just not for me and that I wanted to sort of be with Zeb for a minute and try to figure that out. And not try to be what someone else might want me to be or what I might need to be. And I felt a lot of freedom in that. But I still, you know, I'm still a storyteller and I'm still, you know, into creating things. And so when I got that job in the Caribbean, it was like, this shit is on. You know, like I can, and I, it clicked for me, like, I'll just be one of those guys behind the camera.
Gave you kind of a new lease on
life. Yeah, and then I went at it like gangbusters. And, you know, I wound up, you know, I could not get a fucking job in New York to save my life. Like, I was doing temp jobs and like, I mean, literally, I could not get a job. But I made a friend who knew someone who knew someone who knew a man named Andy Lassner.
Yes, you guys we've know. Heard of him.
Yeah, and he's like an, he's sort of
a
one
god.
Of, he's one of my, like fairy godmothers, sort of.
He's a fairy godmother to too many people.
I know. And so he, they were like, yeah, come in for a meeting. And so I flew to LA and like, I can't even begin to tell you.
Oh wait,
you.
So this is when Andy's, I guess, in LA.
Yes, this was like 5 years ago.
Oh, okay.
I wind up flying back to LA scared shitless. I thought for sure I would get off the airport and there'd be people there waiting for me. And that like,
There's an Uber in these days.
I literally went to the meeting at Warner Brothers to meet with Andy and them and then went back to my friend's house and stayed in the house in the bedroom until my flight the next morning.
And like, you went for what? To be a writer for Ellen? No.
To be like, fucking anything. You know, because I was so desperate for a job. I was like, I didn't say this in the meeting, but I was like, I'll be a PA or I'll be whatever.
How did you even hook up with Andy?
A friend in New York knew Andy from Rosie, Rosie Days, and said, you should meet this kid. He's like, you know, he's good, he's smart. And for whatever reason, Andy was like, yeah, send him over. And so I like flew over here and I met with them. Then I met with the line producer, this like really great woman. And I could tell that they were sort of like, oh, like this kid's, you know, there's something about him. But there was no offer or anything. And then months later, like I get another call. I obviously stayed in touch with them, you know, like emailing like, hey, here.
I'm
still looking for a job. Still would love to work at Ellen.
Adorable.
And I wound up getting a job as a researcher assistant. So I started off as an assistant there in the research department, which is really the, if you know anything about like TV talk shows, it's like the fast track for being a producer.
Okay.
Because you're sort of at the ground level for collecting all of the information that they might talk to the celebrity about. And I, you know, had... I had never worked in, I had never done a talk show when I was an actor. I wasn't a fan of them. You know, I didn't know much about them. So it was a real crash course in just that whole job. And so, you know, over time, I'm now living in LA and I'm creating new, healthy, happy memories with this city. I mean, there was a good year where there were parts of the city I could not go to because
yeah, you
it was,
have PTSD from it.
Yeah, big time. Like, that's a real thing. Like,
it's a total real
yeah,
thing.
Yeah. And I felt, I don't know, like grace or whatever, but I just kept showing up and I kept, you know, doing the fucking right thing. And I know I was doing my program and then over time at Ellen, I wound up getting promoted to an associate producer. And then eventually they let me produce some segments. And
did they know of your issues when they hired you?
No, they did not
they
know.
Didn't.
They did not
Andy
know.
Andy didn't know at
no,
all.
No, Andy didn't know, but he found out, you know, I'm sort of, I'm not anonymous in program, but I try, especially, well, you know, I'm here doing this thing
up
with you
now,
guys.
Yeah,
yeah, up till now.
Well, you're not, I mean, I think a better way to put it, like, I'm not out there being like, hi, nice to meet you. I'm seven. I'm a drug addict.
Yeah,
like,
and I was, you know, living at a gas station.
Right.
Shooting
know?
Drugs into my neck. Yeah. I.
But you're obviously not hiding it.
Yeah, no, I'm not. I think I was so insecure and afraid at that job that I was going to get fired or that
right.
I wasn't going to do a good job
yeah,
that
really
I was that I just kind of kept mm-hmm. everything sort of quiet. And
totally.
You know, but eventually, like, you know, when you're working with people for a long time, I was there for like four seasons. You know, they become your family.
Yeah.
And
of course.
So like they, you know, my friends there knew and all that. But the crazy thing is when I first got there, it was like my first job as like, you know, in recovery as a non-actor in Los Angeles. I felt so insecure and so less than and so afraid of everything. And now, 5 years later, that I'm a producer at the Late Late Show with James Corden, I don't second guess myself like I used to in the beginning. And I can track my self-confidence growth over the past 5 years. And like, It's crazy to look back at myself at that time because I was just, you know, super afraid. Mm-hmm. You know, I didn't want to fuck up. I didn't want to get fired. Again, I'm, you know, Juilliard and then the Ellen Show, two very coveted environments to be in.
Yeah.
And, you know, another miracle in my life that I got that job and I got to, some of the best producers and the best writers, the best show on television. And I got like a crash course there. You know, it could have been like, I could have gotten a job at Jerry Springer.
Right.
You know what I mean? And like, I would have been as happy with that. But so again, I'm in this situation where, but this time the difference is I'm awake, I'm sober, and I'm aware of the gift and the miracle that's happening.
You're living in the moment.
And I'm living in the moment, and so I'm showing up. And, you know, there were times at Ellen where I was sort of, I never got mystified by, like, the celebrities or anything, but I would get more sort of mystified by how things work. Like, okay, so you're this guy who does this, and why do you do that? You know, I would sort of have to see everything happening and have relationships with them to sort of know how to do a show. And, you know, it's crazy. Like, while I was at Ellen, there's one of the music coordinators, this girl, Drew, who she and I don't see her much anymore, but I'll always have a really soft place in my heart for her because she, not knowing my story, invited me to go to the Staples Center to see a Rihanna concert.
Wow.
And, you know, I was like, you know, I am a Rihanna fan. It makes no difference. But I went with coworkers after work, dressed nice, sober, happy, and
you were that person.
I was that fucking
yeah,
person.
That's amazing.
And it was like one of to this day. If you had said to me at the beginning of this whole thing, like, what do you want? I never would have ever thought to ask for that or have that kind of experience. But to me, that is like one of the top three experiences of my sober life, that I got to go back there and I got to have that experience. And, you know, we were waiting after the concert for other coworkers to come out. And I stood on the corner that I used to hang out on And I just, like, you know, was so overcome with, like, how grateful I am for my life today. Like, the whole miracle of this whole thing is not lost on me. Like, that's why I take every opportunity to give it back, to help other people, because I'm just like, I can't believe that this is my life. Like, if you had said to me when I was sitting on that street corner that in a few years you'll be an associate producer at the Ellen Show and you'll be going to a concert there for work, I would have been like, do you have drugs on you? And like, what are you smoking?
Because right, that's insane.
Yeah, because I have some and clearly what you're on is better than what I'm on.
Yeah.
And you know what I feel like I'm missing from the story? So you're on the fucking streets. You're on, literally on Skid Row. And for people who haven't been to LA,
it's a tough environment.
Hometown. It's a
tough environment.
Like, you've never seen anything like that unless you've been to, I mean, maybe Vancouver. Here's the thing.
It's
or whatever.
A very, there's like a society down there, and there's right. like a pecking order, and there's like rules. It's not unlike prison, you know, like with how people roll down there. It's a tough, tough environment.
But between the Skid Row and then going home and getting a stroke, something got you literally, I mean, how do you even get off the physical streets? How do you get off of Skid Row? How do you know, like, did you pull that yourself or did somebody pull you off the streets?
No, I somebody told me that I had money.
Oh, that was it. That was okay.
And I was like, and literally I took the bus with my backpack and my cracked out whatever to the SAG office.
And that's what got you off.
And then I got that check. I went, the other crazy thing is like when you're homeless, like you don't have checking accounts.
Right.
And like,
that's what I'm saying.
You don't have cell phones. Yeah, no. And I owed banks money. When I first got sober, like I had warrants in multiple states.
Oh, wow.
I was in check systems at two different banks. Like it took a while for me to, and you know, I'm a homeowner today. So like I've worked very hard to get this shit like in check.
This is actually a huge moment for people if you think, hey, I've ruined my credit.
I had like 400 credit score, and today mine's like, mine's very high and very healthy today, thank God. But it took a lot of work.
But it's possible to get it back.
At that time when I went to the SAG office, I had to like go to a check cashing place. And then, you know, when you're some cracked out person trying to cash like a check for multiple thousands of dollars, they're looking at you a little funny. And so it takes a long time. And I just, you know, I knew that I needed to go home to New York.
Right.
And so
did it yourself, essentially.
Yeah, and I just, you know, I didn't realize that I'd go home and then less than 24 hours later have a stroke. But, you know.
I hate to say it, but it's almost like you kind of did. Like, you knew you needed some help.
I was done and out of ideas. And I had gotten, you know, when I was a kid, I was terrified of physical violence. Like, it used to scare the shit out of me. Like, in school, if kids got into a fight or if, like, I saw something on the street, it would just really bother me. And here I am getting my ass kicked, like, literally once a week, like, into physical fights. Like,
robbed or what was the reason?
No, just, like, fights. You know what I mean? Like, people just... Yeah, it happens. It's like, you know, one time I was trying to steal a crack pipe from someone out of their tent and they hit me in the face with a belt and I still had missing a tooth.
Wow.
If you see.
Wow.
It's like, I just like, you know, the way of the world down there is like, you know, it's prison. It's like, it's a very tough, tough environment. So anyway, I'm like at the Ellen Show. I'm at this Rihanna concert. It's like, I danced so hard at that concert. I'm not a dancer. I had so much fun that night. And I will always have fond memories of those people and that show for, you know, really nursing me back to professional life and giving me, like, you know, the opportunities that I have today. You know, I produced a documentary.
Yes.
That premiered at the Palm Springs Film Festival.
Is it called Shoulder the Lion?
Shoulder the Lion, yeah.
Was it called
Spirit
Will
Lost? It was called
Spirit
Will Lost, but then we went to a poet and we decided to change the title after the Palm Springs Film Festival to make it Shoulder the Lion. It's about three different artists who had some like really fucked up shit happen to them and they sort of take that experience and it motivates their art and they become really successful artists or they get a lot of public acclaim.
You get them on the podcast.
No, you don't even understand that. And I have to be more specific about some of these things. So there, one of them is a guy who's a professional musician who has tinnitus. You know what tinnitus is?
Yeah. Going deaf,
air. Yeah, and he's going deaf. Another one is a painter who went blind, right?
Well, Katie is the inspiration behind Million Dollar Baby. She was the boxer who then got into, you know, she had massive brain damage and now is like a successful sculptor/painter. I'll send you a link to the film so you can watch it.
Please.
It's like really a special, amazing thing. And now I'm a producer at the Late Show.
How did that come about?
So I, you know, I heard that the show was coming down the pike and I was at Ellen under contract and I sort of thought to myself like, that sounds like an amazing opportunity. So I waited till Mike. I did leave Ellen a few months short of my contract ending, but they were gracious enough to, you know, Andy especially, like they recognized that this was like an amazing opportunity. And the thing that's amazing about Ellen is that the people who started that show are still in control of that show. But the thing that's tough for people coming up at that show is that the people who started it are still in control. So there's not a lot of turnover.
Yeah,
you know what I mean. So I had sort of hit a ceiling for like what I wanted to do there. And you know, I met with them, the James Corden people, and immediately. Immediately from the first second I met them, I just like clicked.
Yeah.
And they're like good people, and they're, you know, they're ambitious and they're fun and they're exciting and they're English, and it was like a perfect whole new thing. And I was like, I'm fucking, sign me up. And you know, so I and now I'm, you know, I'm like doing it. It's like insane. Like I, you know, am producing like big people and doing my bits are getting on the show all the time, and I'm having like, you know, all of this professional sort of excitement, you know, because I
You're growing.
Yeah. Yeah. And I'm into it. You know, I don't know where, like I had a meeting a few, like a month ago with someone at CAA, and they were like, you know, you need to do this, you need to do that, and you need to wind up here because we're going to fast track you to this place. And I left that meeting and I thought like, okay, love her. Great. Would love that to happen. But like, I don't have a plan. You know what I mean? Like I'm sort of like in the moment at my job right now. And for me, I'm, you know, especially in my sobriety, I'm very like goal oriented, but I'm having so much fun at this job and that I'm just kind of content with the things the way they are right now. I mean, my biggest thing is like, I want to have a big bit on the show. I want like 25 million views on my YouTube clip. Do you know what I mean? I want the celebrity to like have an amazing time and like come back. And like, I want to get the guests that have become friends of the show, you know? So those are the goals that I have in mind for myself right now.
You're the guy that did that.
Yeah. Or not so much you're the guy that did that. I want to be, I want to like do this thing. You know what I mean? And then I want to do something else. But what that other, here's the thing. My life is bigger and better than I could have ever possibly imagined, hoped for, dreamt up. I couldn't even have envisioned this life for myself today. So I'm just going to like continue doing what I'm doing. And I don't know where I'm going to be in 5 or 10 years, but I have a feeling if it's going on the same path that I've been on, it could be fucking anywhere. But I know that, you know, it'll be amazing. And so I'm trying not to, you know, in sobriety, they say you have to like turn it over a lot and you can't really have expectations. And so I'm just, you know, I love my job. I love the people I work with. And it's, you know, my friends at Ellen, when I have dinner and stuff with them, they're like, we know you're happy. We know you're so fucking happy. We know you're so fucking happy over there. And I'm like, I am. You know, I'm in a relationship today and I have, we bought a house in Palm Springs. And, you know, it's like, it's like adult shit. It's crazy because like, I'm like an adult. And not only am I an adult, like I am a responsible adult, you know?
Which is very hard.
And the crazy thing is nobody in my family or nobody in my life and nobody in, I think anyone in my acting life would have ever guessed that I would come back the way I've come back. And I, you know, I'm such a huge believer in like second chances and, you know, the underdog. And like I said earlier, I'm so excited when someone is out of fucking options and when they're up against a wall, like that is the point that you can choose to do anything. You know, when you're at the fucking very top, you just got to maintain that. It's not as exciting and not as creative. But when you're at the bottom and no one's watching and you have like any opportunity,
there's nowhere to go but up.
There's nowhere to go but up. And like, you know, I think to myself, I'm just beyond grateful for, you know, the life that I have. And I'm not trying to say that my life is perfect because, you know, it's not. And like, I deal with like painful things all the time and letdowns, and I'm an alcoholic. So I'm, you know, slightly obsessive, and I still deal with wanting people to like me. And, you know, especially at my new job, like I want to just keep being like a good, strong worker.
Yet you don't seem to be on Twitter.
I'm not on Twitter.
But you want people to like you. It doesn't, you know.
Yeah,
if you want people to like you, that's what everybody on Twitter is. There are people who want people to like you.
That's Andy. That's a very Andy thing to be on Twitter. I just never got, I don't think people care to hear what I have to say.
Oh,
about,
no. I think you're so put together because you're not on Twitter.
Let me ask you this. I think you kind of said it, but if somebody's listening, and I'm sure there's somebody listening who, because your story is an inspiration flat out, they are struggling. They are at their bottom. Is your advice like it only gets better from here?
My advice is, every situation is different. And I don't want to blanket any advice to anyone because I just think, you know, I think that when you're in a place where you're out of options, the best thing to do is to sort of be open to things that you might not have considered as options prior. You know what I mean? Like, yeah. If you're dealing with like drugs and alcohol, like, you know, just fucking stop.
Well, I mean, that's so easy crazy to say, right?
For me to say. But I think like creatively, when people feel like they're out and then it's over, it's never fucking over.
Which, you know, a lot of people, I think, in LA feel that way because they're actors and they feel like...
Oh, my God. I have so many friends that are...
It's a train.
Yeah.
It's,
and my thing, the crazy thing about acting that I love,
yeah,
is that any fucking day you could get a phone... I watched this documentary today called Hollywood... it's about the Oakland or the Oakwood Apartments. Hollywood... It was like about the... You know the Oakwood Apartments,
yeah, yeah,
where all the
totally
kids stay? Right. And it was... You know, any, this mother was in the document and she's like, at any time my phone could ring and you could be working. And like, as an actor, like, that's the thing that's so exciting. Like, that's also the fucking twist of it is that, yes, like, yeah, it's hard to walk away because at any time, you know, we hear all the time of actors being like, I was giving up and then suddenly I got the call. But to stay engaged and to just, to have that sort of hope is, you know, hope is everything. And I think, you know, you have to be smart and you have to be like willing to work. Like when I was at Ellen, like, oh my God, I worked so many long hours and dealt with a lot of different personalities and really, really like committed to doing a good job no matter what. And, you know, I'm not saying that, you know, you just have to be lucky and smart. I think that there's a, you know, a lot to be said for like showing up, you know, and like working hard and like being a worker among workers and, you know, trying not to take things too personally, especially in this business. You know, like I deal with that all the time, like publicists and people like getting upset about something. And I just have to sort of ask myself, like, this really has nothing to do with me, even though as an alcoholic, everything has to do with me. And I take everything personally, but I'm having to like sort of, even at work, like, we have these big pitch meetings and, you know, I have ideas coming out my ass all the time. I'm constantly pitching ideas. And, you know, like some of them have been great and have been huge hits on the show, but like the most of them have not. Like,
throwing spaghetti at the wall.
Yeah, yeah.
Hopefully something will stick.
I feel like you cannot take things personally to the point that you stop, you start editing yourself and you stop trying.
Yeah.
Because, you know, everyone who's had some big success in this like world that we live in, they have, I would be dumbfounded to find a person who tried one time, got it, and are now great. You know what I mean? It takes a lot of
failures.
Yeah, my failure is like not one that I'm willing to repeat. But I'm willing to have a million other failures. You know what I mean? Like, I'm willing to have bits that go south on the show. I'm willing to like try to sell shows that don't go anywhere.
But maybe that's helped you, I think, because in some way you're like, well, this idea that I had didn't run, but you know what? I'm not where I used to be.
Exactly. My baseline for happiness and success is so at an amazing level.
Yeah.
Because, you know,
you went to a Rihanna concert.
Yeah,
as a dressed, deodorized person.
Brushed teeth, the whole nine.
We've kept you here for a long time. I have a question, then I want to do one last thing. Do you struggle every day with your sobriety?
No.
Or is it easier? Does it get easier?
It's gotten so much easier. You know what I struggle with today is smoking. Mm-hmm. Is something I struggle with. And
are you trying to quit?
I did quit for 2.5 years, but then I picked up one and now it's like I'm fucked.
I've been quit for 4 years. I have that feeling that
Ever pick it up because I had one and then I went like a month and I was like, oh, I'm good. I was like, oh my God. And then
I could do this whenever I want.
And so now I'm
a professional smoker, right?
And, yeah, exactly. But I don't struggle with my sobriety because I do everything that I need to do to sort of keep it right. But I do struggle with like getting my feelings hurt, feeling like, you know,
you're normal.
I'm normal. I
deal
with
pulse.
I deal with all of that other stuff. But as far as my sobriety goes, I mentioned earlier that I have created healthy, sober memories with this city. I've created healthy, sober, normal lifestyle behaviors with my life. So I don't put myself, those thoughts don't, they're not any, they're, I'm sure they're there somewhere, but they're not anywhere in my conscious mind. Like, I'm never thinking like, oh, it'd be great to just go disappear for a few days. I'm like, disappear from this amazing fucking life that I have? Are you kidding me?
That's
like,
great.
I don't want to fuck with that.
That's
so
awesome.
My sobriety is sort of, I mean, knock on wood, like to this day, it feels very solid,
great.
But I feel like not so good saying that.
No,
I work hard at it, you know?
Yeah, it's always a work in progress.
It's always a work in progress.
You've built yourself such a wonderful life that it's not worth giving it up.
Yeah, and I feel very connected to where I came from still.
Yeah.
And like because of that fear and trauma of where I came from, I can't convince myself that there's anything amazing and fruitful if I went back there.
Mm-hmm.
I know without a shadow of a doubt that it's like, you know, very dark. And I don't choose to put myself in that situation anymore.
I think those are good last words. I have a final question for you. Do you have a favorite charity?
I do. There's a it's a charity benefit, and it's happening next Sunday.
Okay.
And it's called Best in Drag, and they are a charity that, where is it?
Please don't tell me it's about drag racing.
Not drag racing. It's for the Alliance for Housing and Healing, and they help homeless street kids have HIV who are homeless on the streets of downtown LA. And they do a big benefit every year where they, like, a bunch of celebrities go and they do a drag show where Miss Connecticut or Miss New York come on and they like try to compete to win Best in Drag, and they raise a shit ton of money, and I volunteer backstage. I do move sets and stuff, and tomorrow I'll be at rehearsal all day like moving sets and helping people. It's super fun.
$150 going to Best in Drag from Failing Up. I'm gonna do that personally.
You're gonna do that personally. Yes, I will match your $150.
Well, there we go.
You you're just like Andy matched ours.
Yes. I know. I heard that, and so I did and I was like
he's like, oh, I was like, how much is they going to make me pay? Yeah. You don't have to match. It doesn't mean anything.
Yeah, no. So we'll figure those details out afterward. Yeah, for sure. But yeah, for sure.
That sounds so fun. Can I come to that?
It's next Sunday at the Orpheum Theater in downtown LA. Oh, and it's like just a fun fucking night.
That looks like a lot of fun.
It's a lot of fun, and it's for a really good cause. And the people that are competing have been working all year at their talents, their costumes.
For this.
It's like a huge, huge honor. There's a big audition process. This is their Oscars. They have to audition to even become a contestant.
Thinking of being a contestant.
Well, I don't think you're getting the concept.
I think you lack some
here.
Of the parts of the requirements.
But I might be able to be a contestant, possibly. No. Although I don't look really pretty with a wig on.
That sounds like so much fun. And especially after that douchebag that like made the AIDS pill like $1,000.
Oh my God, yeah, that guy.
What a dickhead, right?
Yeah.
But did you guys see, this company is making t-shirts with his face on it, like all gross, and the benefits from buying that goes to the AIDS charity.
Oh my God, that's amazing.
It's amazing.
That's the way to go.
It's like full circle, you guys. Yeah. By hating someone, you're helping the cause. That's great.
Yeah, I would much rather have my epic fail be homeless street junkie than anything to do with like hurting people like on that. That's disgusting.
I agree.
It's disgusting.
Right. Zeb, are you on Instagram though?
I am on Instagram.
Zeb Newman?
So Zeb Newman on Instagram.
We can validate you on Instagram. Yeah.
You can
give
validate
you, like,
me.
We'll follow you.
Yes. My partner's, he does hair for like celebrities and stuff, and he's always concerned about his Instagram followers. And I'm like, okay.
What's your partner's Instagram? Do you want to say it?
I think it's
if John. If it's hair, I want to see it.
It's John Ruggiero. John Ruggiero, I think.
I might borrow him.
You guys should follow him too. Everybody deserves some love.
Follow all of us. Just, yes. I think my household is way more, we're into like art and photography and stuff way more than we are in like what people have to say on Twitter.
Okay, that's fair. Nothing wrong with that.
Guys, my Instagram is just dogs.
Well, are you at @_eats on Instagram?
This is my partner.
And on Twitter. I'm @theguyDF. On everything. And Zeb, thank you again
for sharing
your story.
Thank you guys so much. Thank you.
You're true inspiration. Seriously, we appreciate your time.
Of course.
You.
Bye.
Thanks.
Okay.